In this episode of Highly Sensitive Money, I interview Michelle Jackson, a personal finance creator and advocate for equity and access. The conversation delves into the challenges of advocating for social justice within the personal finance space and the impact of external factors on financial decision-making. Michelle's insights provide a valuable perspective on the integration of activism and social justice into personal finance conversations, emphasizing the need for more inclusive and empathetic discussions about money. Her experiences and reflections, along with my hosting, will help you gain a deeper understanding of the impact of policy on personal finance decisions, making this episode a must-listen for highly sensitive individuals navigating the intersection of personal finance and social justice. Michelle Jackson loves to have the financial conversations that are often ignored. Why and how financial policy impact our money, especially women's money? Thank you so much, Michelle, for joining today. I'm really excited to get to have you on the first season of Highly Sensitive Money.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I know we met. So we met at FinCon in New Orleans in October. There was a meetup that I put together for social justice. And I'd love to hear from you, like, what was that meetup like, and how does that compare to other? How did that change this FinCon, if at all, from other FinCons that you've been to?
So I've actually attended, I want to say that was my 8th FinCon. I have alternated years. And so one of the frustrating things for me is that my content is typically designed from an equity, access, and policy perspective. So having you put together this meetup was amazing. It just felt finally like I could visually see my people. You know what I mean? That we do exist in the personal finance creator space, that there are people who aren't gonna say to me, well, why don't you just budget? I'm like, you know, like sometimes it's not the budget, or that many people know how to budget and there are these other external factors impacting their money decisions. So I hope that you continue to do this type of like connecting, and it was just a beautiful space for me and I loved every second of it. It was awesome. Thank you.
I'm so glad. I was worried also about going to FinCon and finding that same response of like, individual, you solve it. And that's not what I saw. But I think that meetup had a lot to do with it.
I think that, I mean, here's the thing. I know the people who go to FinCon very well, clearly, because I've been going for years. And it's not that people, I want to be clear. Like, it's not that people are, How's a good way to say this? They're not all being assholes, is what I want to say. Like, I want to say it this way. But I think that in how people talk about money, whether they're a content creator or not, your lived experience often reflects in what you create. And so if I'm a person, regardless of color, if I'm a person who's like, who deeply believes a thing, and I don't believe that policy impacted anything with my money, I can't change their belief system. Like, they're not there to hear what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to change people's belief systems, because either you're gonna hear what I have to say or you're not. So I am creating my work and community and connections for the people who are here for that message. Because, and then there are people who I regularly communicate with who are like, Michelle, you're such a, you know, lefty liberal. Oh my God. But we have really significant and substantive conversations, because I am like, this is why I believe what I do. These are the statistics. Like, over time, I kind of wear them down. And so I understand that, like, a lot of people aren't there to hear what I have to say. But if they're respectful of me and we are respectful of one another, there's an opening for conversation. But they're not the people I'm trying to help with my work, right? Like, they're not the audience anyway. So that's an important thing to consider. Like, they're not the audience for my work. That would be if they become a part of the audience, that's just a byproduct.
Yeah, that's so important. I remember, are you familiar with a book called My Grandmother's Hands by Rasma Menakem?
No, but now I feel like that's on my reading list.
So My Grandmother's Hands is about somatic abolitionism. It's about our body, understanding what racism looks like and getting rid of racism in our body, because the visceral response we have from people who look different to us is in our body. And it's also like the media keeps training us for that. Anyway, there was one conversation that the author, Resma Menakem, was having with somebody else that I really follow. Her name is Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams. And they were having a conversation on this book and like, how do you overcome racism in your body? And somebody asked, like, what do I do when someone won't listen to me? Like, I have a white friend who will say things that are really hurtful. And this was a video conversation, and Resma and Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, they looked at each other and they laughed. And I don't remember which one it was that said it, but one of them was like, go get a sandwich. Like, go do something else with your life. Like, if this person's not listening, stop wasting your time. We were all just like, wow, just let him go. Like, what is in you that wants to change that other person? That was so, it was so powerful. And it was so silly too. Like, go get a sandwich. Just go do something else.
And I actually freaking love that.
Well, this podcast called Highly Sensitive Money. It's for people who identify as highly sensitive, and highly sensitive is like 15 to 30% of the population, depending on how you measure them. Mm. It's people who just get a lot of sense input. And it could be from like the clothing they wear, to the noise around them, to how they see connections amongst things. One thing that I've noticed in myself and like friends that I see or that self-acknowledge as highly sensitive is that there's just a lot of processing that's needed for any decision. Mm-hmm. And one of like my favorite parts of being highly sensitive, and also one of the most difficult ones for me to become used to, is how much I feel the pain of others. Mm. And like, I've had to really learn how to set boundaries and how to be like, this is just the way the world is. But it also has become fuel. Mm. So this podcast is for highly sensitive people who want to learn more about money, translate money, while really engaging in social justice and collective well-being. And that's everything from like people to a river's right to flow. You know, like all of us just being creating systems that are set up for us to thrive.
I think though, you know, it's interesting because I feel like, are you highly sensitive or are you just empathetic, right? And so to me, it's like this, you know, there are people who operate at higher levels of empathy. And so when you operate at this higher level of empathy and caring and compassion, you feel other people's pain. You feel their joy. You feel all that comes with that. I know a lot of people who operate at that level, and it's hard. It's hard, especially like, you know, within the context of this conversation where we're talking about being creators in the personal finance space. And, you know, for me, I found that I was not motivated to monetize my brand and create money in the ways that other people were with their brands. I felt like there was a huge disconnect with the advocacy work that I was doing, which I didn't realize was advocacy work. Like the types of episodes for my podcast that I was, you know, recording, and the people that I sought out and the stuff that I got excited about was definitely advocacy work. And I always felt like a conflict. And this year it was interesting because finally I was like, I was monetizing other things outside of my personal finance brand. And I was like, that is a better fit. My personal finance brand should not be monetized anymore. Like, this is so energetically not aligned with what I'm trying to do. And that has been such a beautiful gift to myself to be like, this isn't work. I've made more money with my online stuff, by the way, by like being aware that if this one thing is out of alignment, I shouldn't be doing it. And so it's been a much more natural and just aligned way to be online and advocate and do the things I'm trying to do, because I'm not trying to make money with my personal finance. I'm just trying to stand up for people. And I'm just trying to be like, hey, this is a thing, and this is something to think about or to consider. And so that has been a very freeing decision, because I just, the conflict was so, like, for years, I was just like, you know, I'm doing this work and it's, you know, it's work. And it's like, if this is work, I do need to be compensated in some way. And then I finally, like, looking at my overall, like, this is what I'm presenting to the world. I was like, this doesn't need to make money, but this does. And so that's been a really interesting process.
That's really interesting, because I know when I was at FinCon, a lot of the things that I heard were like, get sponsors, get these kind of different things. And I was like, ooh, I don't know if I, one of the things, so I used to work in investments. I was an investment manager and I loved the office that I worked for, the people that I worked for. But I remember at the end when I was like on the verge of being promoted to a wealth manager, like from assistant wealth manager to wealth manager, I remember thinking, I'm going to have to drink more to keep this job. And not against the people, not against my clients. It was just like, it was out of alignment and it was becoming more and more obvious. And there's a history of addiction in my family. So when that thought came in through my life, I was like, that is not how I'm going to solve my issues. That's a huge, huge red flag.
Whoa. It's funny because you're right. Like, I actually do associate that role with like whining and dining and wheeling and dealing and talking to other. So that's, I never would have thought about that. But yeah, wow. Wow. That's interesting.
Well, most of the times, like, people laugh when I say that, but I loved your response. You're like, that's a call for help.
Yeah, like, totally makes sense to me. And the thing is, it's like, you have to trust your gut and you have to trust yourself. And if you know that this isn't right, it's just, if just trust your gut. Like, I've never gone wrong by trusting my gut. Anytime I don't, that's when things go wrong. Every time I go against my intuition, things go horribly wrong. So there you go.
And that was what was interesting for me being at FinCon, of just like, okay, how will I keep doing what I'm doing, the financial content that I'm creating, and also not putting myself in a position where I'm like, oh, should I drink a little? You know, like that's not anything that makes me go towards that. I'm glad to hear how you've separated both and you're like, there are other ways to make money. Not everything has to be compensated.
Well, I mean, so this is like a gray area for me, because as women of color, as a Black woman, I do, like, I am aware that Black women in particular do a lot of unpaid labor. And so it would be different if I were a millionaire. I'm not a millionaire. And so I have to get compensated for the work that I'm doing. However, in saying that, I have to let people know that I would like to get compensated, or be aware that there's more than one way to do something. So that was important. So it's not to say that I'm not trying to get paid for the labor that I create. It's just to say that it has to be in alignment, and I have to, like, a closed mouth doesn't get fed. It does not, it's also out of alignment to be in the personal finance space and not advocate for myself, right? And so that's where that gray area is always so tricky. I create content in a couple of different spaces. Like, I do personal finance, but I also do like the business of online content creation. I have a romance brand, which is hilarious. It's like so fun.
I heard that.
And I haven't written books in a while, but I've been working on them, but they still make money, right? And then I have
like erotica that you're writing?
No,
or what are you writing?
I write romance, not erotica. I mean, they're two very different things. Okay. I hate that when people do that. Yeah, like erotica is erotica, romance is romance. They're two different things. Okay. So romance would be like a romance book. And actually, both are very, very important types of work of literature for women, especially. But I just don't do erotica. I write romance. That being said, I also have a website about Colorado. And so what I was finding was that I had these skills that I had built with my old 9-to-5 job. I had skills that I had built as an online creator. I had skills that I had built working, doing freelance writing, stuff like that for other organizations. And so you can just apply them in the places that make sense and that scale. So again, like I you know, it's a gray area because I want to be compensated for my work. But if there are other things within my brand that can scale easier and there's no, you know, ethical like concerns and there's no like, you know, there's no sitting there agonizing like, is this the right thing to do? That's where it should be focused. And mm-hmm. I am 100% unapologetic about like my Colorado brand. I want that thing to make as much money as humanly possible because that will subsidize the other work that I do. Mm-hmm. So that would be like kind of the way I would think about it. That is, I want Black women, all women, I want us to make as much money as possible, but it doesn't mean that every brand is where that happens. And so that's, yeah. that's why I kind of push back on that. Like we need to get paid. Yeah.
Oh, and I have a similar setup. So I have different income sources and the one that sustains me the most is actually investment management. I still Ooh. Do investment management for high net worth individuals who want to invest according to their values. So we will do impact investing. We will do things that only accredited investors can do and they subsidize the rest of my work. I also do workshops. And when I come into a workshop, depending on an organization with an endowment is going to pay a different amount than an organization that's just getting started, that just getting by. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with everybody paying a different amount because everyone's like, it's going to be the same impact. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's, I learned that actually through Buddhism. Buddhism does like dana. Because for me, being a money coach is a calling. It is my life's work. Like I was built for this work. And dana is like you will get you we give from the place that we have. We give from our abundance. We give from how much we value this. And I see that it works in my life. But I also moved to Mexico. I also moved to a place. I live in Mexico City. So I
oh, I'm so jealous. Why? I think I knew this. I think I knew this and I forgot. Tell me more.
I love Mexico City. The food is so good. My life cost a quarter of what it would cost if I lived anywhere in the U.S. There's so much culture. There's so many, like, everywhere you go, there's always people, like, with instruments. People are so friendly. There's so many dogs. It's such a dog city. And it's beautiful. It's close to everything. You don't like dogs?
I don't like pets. You know what? Denver has more dogs. Like, Denver as a city, there are more dogs than there are kids. So I already live in a dog city. I like animals. But I don't want them in the house or anything. I just like if we're driving down the highway and I see like the buffalo, there's buffalo. So the city of Denver has a buffalo herd. So if we're like driving into the mountains, you'll see them. I love that. Like that's the best thing ever. But they're out in nature doing their free stuff. So I'm like, I want the animals to be free instead of being pets. And I think that's the weirdest thing for a non-pet person.
Well, we have what are called perrijos, perrijas. So perro is dog, hijo, son, hija. So perrijos, and it's the same thing. There's more, I don't think there's more dogs than kids in Mexico City, but it's very much one of those things of like, haven't met someone I want to have kids with, don't want to have a kid on my own. I want to love someone. And here is a dog who is like constantly on my lap. She's sleeping right now next to me. So.
But is she cute and little? I mean, is she
she's
like,
very little. Like, she would not do well in the wild. She doesn't like getting her paws wet.
Well, that kind of dog I can handle. Because that's the dog you put in your big bag. Because I used to live in Paris, same thing. Like, the dogs here are not perritos. Like, they're like dogs. They're husky. They're like big freaking dogs with big poos. But when I lived in Paris, right, like their dogs would be like in their bags and it was very much like a thing. And I'm like, you guys, oh my God. I literally would just eat my way through. This is the real thing. I would just eat my way through Mexico City. Let's be honest here. Let's not talk about that right now because I'll get distracted.
But I mean, it's part of how Mexico City, my decision to live outside of the U.S., and there's many reasons, but one of the biggest benefits is that it gives me so much financial flexibility. So investment management, workshops, speaking, those are the main ways I create income. My community coaching, my money coaching, I only take 10 clients at a time and accessibility pricing. It's the way that I actually give back. So people, I charge people 1-3% of their monthly gross income, which is, I'm realizing that clients are always like, what do you mean? Like, I have no idea how to calculate that. But it makes it so that each 75-minute session is 1-3% of their gross income.
Wow. Okay. That's
so awesome. Money coaching isn't the moneymaker for me, yet it's one of the things that super like feeds me, because there's so many ways to get compensated. Right? Sometimes it's financial. Sometimes it's just in meaning. Sometimes it's in connections or in fun.
I love this so much. I'm like all excited. I love how you think, and it's so refreshing. What I think about when you're talking is, I feel like you need, did you get a chance to speak with Julian and Kirsten from Rich and Regular?
Oh, no.
Those two are people that need to be like in your circle of connection. They are so lovely, but they, the way that they think about bringing income into their work, it's very separate in terms of like the impact on the audience that they're serving. So to your point, you are looking at negotiating with like financial institutions, what have you, and they've got deep pockets and they can take care of all the things. Julia and Kirsten have a similar philosophy. They do not pass the cost on to their community. And I love that. I wish more people in the personal finance space would think about that as a way to some and as a way to broaden their message and make things accessible for their community. I love it.
You know, and I actually learned about this from my hairstylist, which is so random. Okay. So I have curly hair and I'm super, I love my hair. It's like the thing I am most vain about. And I, about 3 years ago, I was like, I'm going to start getting curly haircuts.
Oh.
And they're expensive. They're expensive. Oh. I think it was like $250 for a haircut. And I'm like, I've never paid that much for a haircut. But I treated myself to a haircut. And then I was like, okay, twice a year, I will do this.
Oh, wow.
And she, and then my hairdresser told me that she could charge $500 for her haircuts because she's got 20 years of experience, but that she does not like working with people who can pay $500 for haircuts.
Okay, tell me more. Tell me more.
So what she does is she keeps her rate at $250 and she just has longer waiting times. And if people don't want to wait, they can go somewhere else and pay $500.
Wow.
It's this idea of like, I don't have to have unlimited amounts of income because it just pushes back. It's like, I don't have to have unlimited amounts of Snickers bars. You know, I just need the right amount. Like,
I mean, Reese's peanut butter cups, like that's a whole conversation.
But really, like how many of those could you eat in a row before you're like, okay.
I'm COVID be like fluffy Hunger Games. For a reason, okay? I am COVID fluffy for a reason. Don't even try me. I could win that battle, okay? Like, I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying there's a reason why I'm COVID fluffy.
Well, from my hairdresser, I got that idea of like, do I want to? And it's not that I don't want to work with people who pay more.
Right.
And yet the message that you send out is different.
Ooh.
And yeah. I want to have, I personally, knowing who I am, it's like I want to have a wide variety of clients. So my pricing better be accessible for all of them. Wow. There's five main questions that are kind of the structure that I have for talking with experts like yourself. And the first one is, what was the financial background of your childhood? And do you see it continue to impact you today?
100% it still impacts me today. But my parents divorced when I was little, like many American parents do. And so my parents divorced when I was six and a half, seven. And what happens with American women, like statistically, what happens is a high percentage of American women basically go into poverty because, you know, that dual income is gone. And, but at that time, back when I was a child, my mom was actually a stay-at-home mom for 7 years. Like she did like little like part-time jobs and stuff like this. But my dad had really, I feel like the dynamic at that time, not even just my dad, but just how culture was that the wife would be at home. And so when they divorced, my mom really didn't have a lot of like skills because she tried to work, but they were like a military family and like all this stuff that goes with that. And so money was always very difficult and hard, and there were problems and like nothing good. And mm-hmm. so it's one of those things now that I still, like, every single day I have to be really in my head about how money comes into my life. Like, energetically, mm-hmm. I have to be on it, because what I saw was just so hard. And, you know, for many reasons, I will say mom's good, things are good. But it's hard because those experiences, those foundational experiences, still are like, they're in your DNA, you know? And mm-hmm. so because of that, it's like I'm trying to change my DNA. And I feel like yeah. that is really hard.
But and the so work there, you're doing for yourself and then sharing it with others, it's transformational.
I mean, it is, but like candidly, I backslid last year. I had long COVID. I was not well for like 8 months, and things just did not go well financially. And I wish that people would be candid about the fact that that can happen, especially if they're growing their own business and stuff like I prepared well and whatever, and then I backslid. Mm-hmm. But I think that's just like, that can happen just in life. Like you're like trucking away and then you get hit by a car, or you're just mm-hmm. everything's good, and you get married and your spouse is like, oh, by the way, I've got this like $30,000 debt. And, you know what I mean? Like, things come up, and like how resilient you are when those things come up also is important to think about. Like, I'm a lot more resilient nowadays. So like, I was sad that I backslid, but I was like, well, okay. like I, you know, this sucks, but I'll be fine. So my DNA is changing, but DNA is your DNA. Like, so it just, it's like, it's kind of frustrating, but you know, each time is a little better, right? Like, each time something goes good or wrong, it's like, okay, well, you know, this is great, or, oh, this sucks. And so that's been an interesting thing to learn about myself and observe. And I don't wish long COVID on anyone, by the way.
Yeah.
Really sucks.
Yeah. And it's just like the cyclicality. I link budgeting and the moon, because you know how the moon is like full and it's empty and it's growing and it's shrinking. And that's often how money is. And we think that it's always supposed to be growing, just like we think we're always supposed to be happy and we get so upset when we're not. Mm-hmm. No, we change all the time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's like simple things like, oh, you didn't sleep enough, or your feet are cold, you know? Or sometimes you hate your job and you're drinking too much.
Your foot is outside your blanket. You're like, I'm too hot, you know? So I get frustrated with myself sometimes, but I think also just being like, treating myself from a place of grace is also very important to me. So it's like, now that I'm like, be kind to yourself, Michelle, because if you're not kind to yourself, no one else is going to be kind to you. You got to be the first person to be kind to yourself. And so when I'm doing my content and I'm creating the work that I'm creating, I always talk about like, just be nice, like, to yourself. Like, you're doing the best you can from where you're at. Maybe you made the same mistake 7 times. I don't know why it was 7 times, but maybe the 8th is when you learn the lesson, right? I feel like there's so many people out there who are so hard on themselves, and there's so many people who are just not nice people who are just like beating down on folks. And I just don't want to be adding to that kind of energy out in the world. Like, I just, that's not my vibes. I want to be kind to me. I want to be kind to you. I just, you know, and that's a practice. Like, that's work to not sit there and be like, well, why aren't you like, da, 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 and what comes from that? Like, nothing is positive from that. So yeah. It might feel like I'm Pollyanna, but hey, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the Buddhism, it's like, if life is suffering, once you just relax and like, suffering is going to come up, and then you're not shocked. So sometimes I feel like people can be so brittle, like any little thing goes wrong and they fall apart. But one of the benefits maybe of being a person of color, being a woman, is that you just get used to being like, the system's not set up for you. You're constantly being pushed back. Like, there's the way. You're just like, well, It just, it makes you more resourceful, and it makes you, when we come to the other side of it and we realize that the way that we're treated isn't personal. It's not because I'm less than. Because, I mean, I just think of the statistics of, like, a white man gets $1, a Latina gets 53 cents for the same work. And I have personal experience of, like, asking people, how do I compare to other people in my position and getting a raise from it, you know, without them actually telling me what the number was. The raise that I got was much bigger than the cost of living adjustment. And I swear that if I had not asked that question, how does my salary compare to other white women in my position? How does my salary compare to men in my position? I would not have had that raise. And it that experience with money, just like, okay, I have to do this everywhere in my life. I mean, I could sit here and be like, oh, this sucks that that is not set up fairly, but that doesn't give me energy. That just depletes me.
Ooh. Yeah. 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 And I think that, so one of the things that I've really thought about in this past couple of years in particular, it's like, how do I react to the things around me? Because to your point, the reaction can be depleting, right? So if I'm constantly in reaction mode, like, your body feels that, your heart feels that, your soul feels it. For me, I just, I'm no longer willing to give that kind of energy to people. I don't want to react all the time. I'm not interested, but I do want to, like, really think about how I manage my reactions when I do. Like, is it, if I'm reacting to something, do I react personally? You know how, like, people react really personally and you're like, just because I used the word you does not mean you. It means, like, you, like a group of folks, you know what I mean? I find that one to be a hard one because there are people in my life where we'll have conversations and everything is about them. Like, they react, everything's like an attack. And I'm like, not everything is an attack. Don't you get tired? And it's tiring to be around them because everything, it's like they have to, like, and I'm just like, maybe if you sat there and were like, you know, I hear that. And I hear what you have to say. And there you go, like, managing a reaction. And I feel like in the personal finance space too, it's like you'll hear people say certain things, with the exception of, I can't believe I just forgot his name. It's because he blocked me. That's why. What's his name again?
That old white guy. I don't know who blocked you.
Yeah, you do, because he's famous. Oh my God, I can't believe
David Ramsey?
Yeah, oh yeah. So, like, he's so grumpy. And I was like, Dave, why are you so grumpy? You're rich, white, and a man. I wrote a post about it and I got, like, years ago, and I got blocked, and I'm like, you should be so joyful. You know, like everything in your life is set up. Like, why are you so angry? You know, like, if you were chill, you know, but that was even before we got into the math of what he, you know, was talking about. But so just think about it. Like, yeah. Thanks, Dave.
So, that's so funny. So, he blocked you.
I'm glad his team blocked me. Bye. Good riddance. Because I don't need that in my life. Okay. I don't. Mm-hmm. Likewise, like, how we're reacting and interacting and, you know, to folks, like, we have to manage how we receive information and how we, like, react to it. And it's taken a while.
What do you do when you feel overwhelmed? When there's just too much coming? You go hiking?
I go hiking, I go soak in a hot tub, I, like, go for happy hour. Like, no, you know, like, it's great. Like, there's lots of ways to, you know, yoga. Like, there's a lot of ways that, you know, a walk, I'll read a romance, you know, like, I'll just chill out and decompress. There's enough going on in the world that I'm just not going to react to everything. I'm just not doing it.
So with your work in social justice, and actually, could you tell us a little bit about your activism and your social justice and how, like, what needs do you see because you work in personal finance, because of your background, that other people may not see? And how does your social justice work respond to those needs?
So how do I put this? I have always been, like, low-key an activist, which is really interesting because my parents are not. they are divorced happily, but neither one of them ever like went to protests or any of this kind of stuff. So I started doing like activist work around 16. So I started boycotting Arizona. I'm not going to say why, but like I have, that's my longest boycott. Hate that state. Beautiful though. The only way I'll go there, the only way I'll go there is if I go on a reservation, because that's not Arizona. You know what I mean? Like, so I have boycotted, like a financial boycott of Arizona since I was like 17. So I'm a very like, I mean what I say, I'm consistent, and I've been doing, you know, protests and financial protests and things like that. So in terms of my personal finance content, the activism comes up in a different, several different ways. Excuse me, primarily in the way that I think about having financial conversations and content design. I find, kind of what I alluded to earlier in our conversation, that oftentimes when people in the personal finance space talk about money, they are always logic driven, but the logic is the logic that benefits them most, right? Like, and then there's, so an example would be if I am a cis white male, like, and things, so in this gentleman's life have been pretty like even, like things have been good. Of course, it's logical for me to be like, well, you know, why don't you just do this? Like, it worked for me. And I'm like, bro, like, I, you know, I understand why there's a disconnect. And I can say that because I've lived around white people for most of my life in Colorado. And so it gives me, I think, sometimes an insight into sometimes the blind spots that people have. Mm-hmm. Because I'm like, how would they know? How would this person know? That could be a wealthy black person. Like, how would they, like, some funny things that I like to follow are celebrity money conversations. I love celebrity money conversations. And one of my favorite things to see right now is second generation, like Nepo baby. It's really interesting to me because, you know, especially for black people, there's this conversation about passing money along to their children and providing a better life. And within, you know, that happens within nepotism, really, right? And seeing how that happens in different families is so fascinating to me. So like LeBron James is an interesting example. This weekend, you know, basketball weekend, he's hundreds of millions of dollars this man has, but he's like, look, my college age son is about to play his first game in college or whatever is going on, and I'm not playing for the Lakers that weekend. I'll be gone. I'll be prioritizing him. Mm-hmm. And so it's really interesting to see just how he's able to parent his children and be there for them. Whereas someone who's not him, they don't have policy in place so they can do that. We don't even have, in the US, we don't even have vacation time. We do not have, like, when I lived in Europe, I could not get them to understand that literally we do not have a law in place that gives us mandated vacation time, like a federal level law. That the fact that we get 2 weeks a year is just like kind of random, and that it depends on the job, and most people get 10 days, and Lord knows you can't do much with 10 days, right? And so like, what would happen in someone's life if there was just that policy on family leave, or excuse me, not family leave, on vacation, regardless of if you're single, family, whatever. What if we just had 3 weeks a year? Because again, 10 days doesn't do anything. If we had 3 weeks a year, how could that change our lives? And we could like piggyback that on a long weekend or whatever. Like, can you imagine how rested we would be? And like how we would change how that would influence our decision making because we are rested. I like to talk about policy because policy changes what we decide on. So an example is universal meals. So right now, states are slowly beginning to, there are some states, let me put it this way, that have passed universal meals for children at school. Now, what's really funny to me is I don't remember paying for food at school, not until like high school, right? Like, I don't remember an exchange of funds in order to eat as a small child. And our food was fresh because Colorado. But also that decade, like back then, right? Like they just made the, like you would go to school.
It was food. It wasn't plastic.
It was food. And so some of the like conversations nowadays, I'm like, do you not remember going to school and the lunch team made your meals? Like they were real meals. They weren't coming from Sysco, right? So I bring up this universal meals to say the emotional labor, especially on moms, regardless of income, of having that one thing off the table is huge, huge. They know that no matter what comes up, their kids are good. That's one less thing. And they can, they have the emotional, that emotional labor can be used to make other decisions about other things. That's, I'm not even a parent and I know this. This is common sense. And then actually from a like policy perspective and like just capitalism, in states that pass that law, you know what has to happen? You know what happens? Grocers become more competitive. They have to drop their prices on certain products in order to compete with the fact that parents don't have to like meal plan in the same way.
Wow. That's such an interesting.
If I were like doing talking points for Democrats, I swear to God, I'm like, you always have to lead with the benefit to them, like to people. So if you're sitting there and you're trying to get these, like, yes, it makes sense to do this because it's the right thing to do by people. But a lot of people are selfish and don't care about that. But you know what they do care? They care that their grocery bills will lower as a percentage because it's competition. That they understand and they care about because it impacts them directly.
Right. Because if they don't have a kid, they're like, well, what do I care? These kids are getting fat. Or what if their kid's already in college? They're like, well, that doesn't bother me.
That doesn't help me now because my kids are out. And so I'm like, if I'm, so we had a policy here for the last two summers where transit was free during the summer. So in 2022, I think it was 2022. We had a month of transit across the state of Colorado for free with municipalities that participated in this program. And the idea, it was because we are dealing with climate problems. Okay. Like we're having problems and we have horrible traffic. There's two things, horrible traffic, climate, like there's a lot going on. And so they're like better fare for better, low, no fare for better air is what it's called. And the whole idea is to encourage people to use transit and reintroduce them to it. And it went really well. Like people's usage of transit shot up. This summer, they did it for 2 months. So the first one was 1 month. The second time was 2 months. But one of the things that went wrong, interestingly, was there were a lot of like things with, we have trains and buses. The trains in particular this year, they were doing a lot of like service work. And I'm like, why the hell would you do that during this time? Because you want to get people to buy into using this. But if they're not serving them on the schedule that they stated, that's a negative experience. So it's really interesting, the data from that from the summer, bus usage flew through the roof. Trains dropped, even though the last year train usage went up, right? But what they don't talk about is how much money people saved. How much money we saved by having free transit. And one of the things I argue, because I have a Colorado website, I'm like, look, hopefully I'll keep posted because I think we'll probably do 3 months this year. But I'm like, instead of being like zero fare for better air, you need to also add it as a marketing, like part of how we market to tourists. If you visit Colorado and you are spending money here, you can save money on transit because it's free these months. Looking forward to seeing you. You know what I mean? Like, it's just how you think about the message and the impact. And I think about that a lot in the content that I design, right? It's like sometimes, and I just apparently have time to think this way, but I'm just like, sometimes we make things harder than they need to be because we forget that people are self-focused. So you have to think about...
So you're saying that your focus, when you're doing social justice, you're looking at like, how does it benefit the person who's listening? How does implementing social justice benefit them? Okay. For me, it's like, how do I just feel a little less pain that you're not in pain?
No, just I mean, I don't want people to be in pain. I do not want you to be in pain. Like, I feel that. But if I'm trying to get people who are listening to my content to change their soul, then I need them to think about where they're coming from. And this is very much I can't believe I'm about to say it this way. This is a very capitalistic way of approaching social
work. It's very individualistic. It's very individualistic. So I just started reading this book, I started reading this book called Caliban and the Witch by Silvia Federici, and it's about primitive accumulation. So she's looking at Marxism, communism from the point of view of a woman. And she's connecting the fact that the witch hunts that happened in Europe, a lot of like the way that they were able, it was because after the Black Plague, there wasn't enough labor. So they wanted to have more people. And the people who were doing contraception were women. So women who did contraception, who like, because people were managing their birthing in order, because they couldn't feed all their kids, right? Ooh. So in the 1400s, women all knew how to like, what do I have to do to not get pregnant? Which is something we don't have access to. Now it's been medicalized so much. Mm-hmm. Right?
But so when you think about it, this is still happening right now. Keep going. Mm-hmm. Keep going. This is the same conversation.
And there's a portion in that which she's going to, I haven't figured it out yet. I've just started reading the book, but she's talking about the individualism that had to happen. And there's one really interesting story where the Jesuits who are in Canada colonizing the indigenous people, they're criticizing this tribe, I forget their name, and they're telling them like, all the men are sleeping around, all the women are sleeping around, you guys are all acting like you're equals. You don't even know whose kid is who. And the person who responded, the indigenous person, he was like, what do you mean? The kids are the tribe's kids. They're our kids. They're everyone's kids. Uh-huh. Right? And the freedom that people had, that both genders had, was horrifying to people colonizing. And they talked about like it took a lot of time, it took generations, and it took a lot of violence to get indigenous people to start to subjugate, or to that particular tribe, for that particular tribe to start to subjugate their women. But once you start oppressing the women within your group, and a lot of time it's that part of like you're being so oppressed that then you oppress in order to just stay on top. Like there's this one song where I forget the name of the singer, but she's like singing a love song to her black man. She's a black woman, about how she sees them being treated, and that doesn't mean that they get to treat her the way that they're treating her.
Ooh, ooh.
But it's just one of those things of like it's poison. Mm. Oppressing others is poison.
And the thing is, like the person who's oppressing others, they don't see it, right? Like they don't see that they're doing that. They cannot. There's so many examples in the world right now of people doing this, and they don't see it.
I think it's just a different mindset, though, because if you live in a very individualistic society where we are very separate, then it's easier to say your pain does not matter to me. But if you live in a more communal society where we're all taking care of each other and we all experience each other as important, and like, where does that even exist, right? It doesn't exist anymore. But what has to happen within you for you to walk by someone who's houseless, by you to walk from it, like by a child who's hungry and not do anything?
You know, one of the things that is happening across the U.S., but I'm going to speak specific to Denver. Right now, there is a state that has, no, let me say it this way. So there is a migrant crisis that is coinciding with an unhoused crisis here in the city of Denver. Mm. And one of the things that's happened is there is a state that is, and I'll just say it, Texas is sending busloads of people into the city. But the thing is, Denver is not a big city. So like we can see the people coming in, we know that they're migrants. Like we can tell. We also know our unhoused, like a lot of the people we see over and over again. So there is this, for some people, there is a tension, right? Because The migrants are being brought here. It's dangerous for them just from like just the weather. We don't have, I mean, just the weather. They are intense now. They are intense. They're coming from warm places. It is, and Colorado's not that cold anymore. And it's still life. Yeah, it's very nice here. I troll people all winter long because I work from outside. Like after we finish talking, I'll sit on a patio, right? Wow. But if I'm from a tropical place, at night it is life-threatening weather, depending on what's happening weather-wise. And so for me, I believe that both groups are human beings that need a home. Like, right? It's very simple for me in my mind. But I'm hearing a lot of conversation like, well, these people are Americans and blah, blah. Like they're, and this is a very liberal city. Mm-hmm. And it's so frustrating that one, that we're being put in this position in terms of the state inundating the resources that we have. Like we only have so many resources and, mm-hmm. you know, Texas and their governor are deliberately sending people to inundate us for whatever reasons. That's not this part of the conversation. And so we're being put in a position, people who are trying to facilitate help for these communities, that they're having to make very difficult choices, and it's not right. Like to me, I think we're human beings. We're human mm-hmm. beings. And if I were struggling, I would hope that you would treat me with kindness and courtesy and just get me to where I need to go. Yeah. Like that's all, you know, like that, but that's not how people are. And so it's been very interesting to see how we have been grappling with like just empathy and the actual resources that we have. And like, you know, the conversation, like the subtle conversation about how we think about unhoused people and how they got there. You know, it's just been
I remember hearing your episode, and I'll link it to this, your episode on houselessness, on white houselessness in Denver.
Yeah.
And how it made you feel like, looking at this, you're like it's not going to actually change.
Yeah.
And that's heartbreaking, and it's
That episode, thank you for listening to it, by the way. That one, one of the things I realized is, you know, people nowadays are very vocal and upset about homelessness, houselessness in Denver. But I felt like when visually it was more black and brown people, because it was, you know, like you visually could see black and brown people at that time, no one really piped up. But now when it's like visually a lot of white people, like people see themselves. I think part of it is they see themselves in these folks' faces, in their faces, right? So they're like, this could be them. And that is very mm-hmm. scary. And that's why I recorded the episode. I was like, you know, now I get it, right? Like it's easy to ignore people that you don't see, right? But when the people look like you, it's hard to ignore that. And that bubbles up some fears and feelings or whatever is in your body about what's going on. I will say, I've also been very heartened by how compassionate people have been, right? Like, I think a lot of people in the metro area, the Denver, like, metro area, they're like, look, this is our problem. We're going to work on this. And they are our neighbors. So you'll hear that a lot. They are our neighbors, because they are. We actually see the same people all the time. And so right now, it's a hard conversation. It's, you know, I'm human, like there are things that bubble up in me too. And I'm just like, you know, I have my own thoughts. But it's, again, like being a compassionate human being, I don't ever, like karmically, I don't want to ever do something where 7 years later, karma comes back. You know, like, and so I always want to treat people well. I want people to feel like they're being seen. If you say something to me and I'm not feeling that I'm unsafe, if you greet me, I'm going to greet you back. Like it's pretty simple, because again, to your point earlier in the conversation, things kind of ebb and flow. Things happen to people. You never know why people are where they are, whether they're very wealthy or not. You don't know mm-hmm. what happened. Mm-hmm. And so I just never want someone to experience me. You know, sometimes, you know, sometimes people experience you on the worst day of your life or when you're having a moment. And I try to be like really aware, like how are people experiencing me? Because I never want 5 years from now, you see me and you're like, oh, Michelle, she was such a diva. like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want that. Because nowadays stuff comes up, okay? Like,
yeah, it's recorded for posterity. So,
girl. So I want to live my life in alignment with how I want people to experience me and just how I want to treat people. Yeah.
And we also have to acknowledge that we change, right?
Yeah.
So there's things that maybe I'm saying that I believe in that I am today that 5 years ago to in the future may not be true. Just like there were things the person that I was 5 years ago, I no longer am. So we also have to give each other grace as we're shifting and changing and seeing things that we didn't see before. And I feel like a lot of the times we just pretend that if someone changes their mind, we can't believe them at all anymore. And it's like, no, they changed their mind. They grew. Like that's part of our human evolution, hopefully.
Hopefully.
So I listened to another one of your episodes, but you talked about learning to take more rest. And that you didn't grow up seeing people in your family rest or being able to rest, right? Speaking to what you said earlier about LeBron James can take the weekend off, but so many parents can. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious if you could talk more about like, what was your family responses or maybe your friend's response or maybe your own inner response to you deciding to take more rest? And did you take more rest before long COVID or was it long COVID that was like, all right, now you sit down?
No, I have I've been team take all the rest you can for years and years and years now. Mm. And part of that was because I worked a job that I loved, but one of the things that they don't tell you about work in the U.S. I can only speak to my experience here, is a lot of times they will work you to the capacity that you show you can work. So, you know, a lot of the conversation nowadays, you'll hear people being like, I'm not compensated for the work that I'm doing. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by this. So when I first started my job, I was working with 100 adult students at any given time at an English center, at an international English center. So there were like 50 in the building with me and 50 on their way to the U.S. And so I was doing like immigration, admissions, events, a student, like I was supervising the student assistant, like a lot. Mm-hmm. When I finished my job, it was 600 students. There were 300 in the building, 300 on their way, and then all those other
And your income was duties. Six times as much, right?
No. Okay. And so this is where I was like, I am tired. This is a lot. I'm worn out, and they worked me to what I showed I could do, and then they worked me. Like, this is when people have heart attacks and stuff from the pressure and from the stress. So what happened was I had started reading stories about Black women dying, young Black women dying from heart disease, like from heart attacks and stress and hypertension and all those kinds of things. And I had been not well. Like I could tell I wasn't well. And I was like, I need to like, and I like the last year of my job, this is funny though. I would go hiking for 2 hours. Cause you know, Colorado, I was right by the, like where we worked was like at the base of the mountains. So I would go to the park that was at the base of the mountains, like 15 minutes away, and go hiking for 2 hours. And one of my student assistants, we're still friends to this day. She jokes with me. She's like, Michelle, she goes, Michelle, I knew at the end, like you were just so exhausted. I was like, I was just done because I was salaried. What could they do? Right.
Right.
And the way that I was hired, they couldn't fire me. Right. So it was just hilarious at the end because I was like, I'm going hiking. I worked by a hot yoga studio. So I'd go hot yoga. Like I was just like anything I could do just to like take down the stress. And then when I worked for myself, like I left the job and I flew from Denver to LA, LA to Hawaii. I was in Hawaii for a week, Hawaii to Australia. And I was there for 2 months. And then I came back and did the same like route back. And it took a year for my body to like calibrate. Like I was like the stress was so bad. It was so bad. And I also had a long commute. Because they were working on the highway. So we have horrible traffic here. And then they were working on the highway that last year. And so the last couple of years, it was like 2 hours one way.
Wow.
And 2 hours. So it was this long commute. It was just too much. And I was taking the bus. So it wasn't like I was driving it. So myself and hundreds of other workers at the university, we would get on the bus for free. That was a positive. And then we would go to sleep. And then we would get there. And I was like, this is not how life should be. This sucks. And so I was like, this, everything about this sucks. I'm so stressed out. I'm not respected. I'm not getting paid right. And I just, this is horrible. And it was frustrating because I loved the organization. Yeah. I loved the work, but you can only love something for so long, right?
Yeah.
When you feel like you're being done dirty. I had a colleague, I mean, no, but it gets worse. So I had a colleague for 5 years. She would roll her eyes and sigh when I spoke in front of other people. She would pretend like she didn't see me. She would bump me in the hallway. She worked in the office right next to mine.
Wow.
For 5 years. She would pretend like she, like it was bad. And I feel like I've forgotten how bad it was, but it was so bad. It was so bad. And I just was like, you know, and so why do I prioritize rest? Because I've earned it. So yeah. I go to the mountains, I go to the hot tub, I go to hot springs, I relax, and it is beautiful. If I had children, they'd come with me, or grandma would have to, you know what I mean? Like, I want rest for everybody that I know. It could be for one day, it could be a staycation away, right? It doesn't have to be crazy.
It'd be rest.
But I need people to prioritize rest. Like, your brain can't even function properly without it. When it took me a year for my body to feel right, a year, like, I was like, what is, like, why aren't I, it, I knew I was better when I was like, wow, like, the clarity of thought, like, this is insane. yeah, because I think I was feeling attacked all the time.
One of the things that happened for me when I became I'm going into my third year as an entrepreneur, but I worked myself really hard. I burnt out June of this year. Because I just kept pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And like, I'm not on social media right now at all because it was just one of the things that, like, it's not making me any money. I'm not enjoying it. Let me get off of it. But I remember, and I see this in other people, of like, you become an entrepreneur and you end up just like becoming your own extractive boss. Did that happen to you at all when you stepped into entrepreneurship? Or were you like, I'm not doing that?
I think that everyone goes through that part of their entrepreneurship business. And I think that some people stay in it because they're not deliberately thinking about lifestyle design as it relates to their business. So a lot of times we go into working for ourselves and then we kind of like work the same way we did for someone else, right? We don't sit there and think, well, does it make sense for me to set an alarm to wake up? Right? Like, do I need to wake up at that time or can I just wake up naturally? Does it make sense for me to work, you know, 8 to 6 when maybe 9 to 3 is when I'm more, you know, creative or more focused? Does it make sense for me to work? You know, I often hear people talk about like, oh, I work all the time as like in the beginning you do because you're just trying to figure things out and get momentum. But it's like, am I even moving forward with the work schedule that I've set for myself? Does this make sense? To your point about social media, over the years, I don't have any kind of social media policy or strategy because it really doesn't make me. Twitter used to until Elno bought the platform. And so a lot of the companies that were reaching out to me, they're off the platform now. The only way I'm on Twitter is for Spaces, which is the only thing he hasn't ruined yet, but I'm sure he'll figure out a way to ruin that too. So Spaces is basically like Clubhouse, but on the Twitter platform. Okay. And that has been great. I love Spaces. Other than that, like, I think most people are doing a lot of things that haven't been proven to them to be impactful or effective for their personal business. So I think there's a percentage of time that you have to experiment and test things out. And then there's a moment where you're like, this isn't working. So like for me, I'm just so not interested in social media. like if I'm on it, it's like an afterthought. It's not an active part of my strategy. But it took a while to figure that out. Like, I prefer to meet people in person. It's crazy. But the people that I've met online, most of them I've met in person. And that has been the most lucrative part of my business, is the connections that I've met with people. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't I prioritize that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
like if so-and-so has met me and they're like, Michelle might be a little wacky, but she's good people. And we're going to connect her with so-and-so from this big company. And that's happened over and over again. What does that tell me? That I need to prioritize those relationships. And ultimately, that's really what you should be doing. Most people, it's funny, we're talking about social media because I just released a podcast episode about this last week on Thursday, I think, on my Creators Getting Paid platform. And most people are getting social media wrong because it's not social. It's not social. It goes back to the whole like reacting to a lot of random stuff. Most people are not on social media to be social. It's like, social is seeing people's faces. Social is like hearing something that you disagree with and like being able to have a conversation around that without feeling like you're being picked on or it's like personal. Like sometimes you just don't agree. It's okay. We're not supposed to agree on everything. Social is building connections and ties and understanding what, like, now that I have met you now twice, this is the second time, and I'm seeing your face, and I know you're Mexico City. They're just things I know I'm paying attention to, right? You've got beautiful earrings. Maybe I notice a beautiful pair of earrings, and I'm like, like from an Instagram influencer in Mexico City, and I'm like, Deanna, oh my God, I saw these earrings. You might like them. You know what I mean? Like, there's things that you get to know about people that don't happen unless you're really intentional on social media. And if you're on social media to make money, everything about that is transactional instead of relational, and I'm relational instead of transactional. And so that also goes back into how I designed my business, right? So like, I want to, for my Colorado project, I want to get ad revenue on that website. I don't need to do social media for that project. I just need to do search engine optimized content, and it converts. You know what I mean? And I can quietly work on a post once a week, twice a week, whatever my schedule looks like. And that's awesome. Right. So I think, you know, just being thoughtful about like, what is it that I'm doing? What is my goal? And do these things even make sense? And most people, I feel like, don't sit down and think about the strategy and the alignment and what's really moving the needle for their business.
Yeah. And there is a period of like throwing spaghetti at the wall, seeing what sticks. But after a while, like, you have to start to just step back and learn. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that throw the spaghetti and see what sticks is hard because no one tells you how long that period should last.
Yeah.
And so that's been, I think, the hardest part of building my business is figuring out what really works for me. And that ideation, that this conversation's come up a couple times recently, is just that testing and ideation, a period of a creative business, is so hard. Like if you're running a burger restaurant, right? You would always have a regular burger, and then you'd have like a specialty burger, and like some other like situation, like a vegan one, right? And then you would just experiment with the toppings. But in a creative business like these, the experimentation is really broad because we hear a lot of things. It's like, well, you should be on YouTube. You should do this. You should do that. And I'm like, what if I don't want to be on YouTube? What does that mean for my brand? Mm-hmm. So like in my case, there are all these things that I tested out. And it's funny to me because the stuff that I do now, I love. And they're so in alignment with me. But it's funny because I don't know that I would have realized that in the beginning, right? So I have a newsletter-based business. I love it. Why? Because I like writing. I like multimedia that can happen within the context of that project. I like interviewing people, so I get to interview people for that project. I like talking. I like to talk. I like meeting new people, and so I can do that within the context of that project. And I like that it's a soft sell. I don't have to like beat your head over the, like, buy from me, but I don't have to do any of that. I just have to provide, like, design and create the content, and people pay me. I got a payment yesterday, and it's great. Mm-hmm. And it grows and it scales. That's a big one. That project scales. So I can lean into all these things that I enjoy. I have a strategy. Totally makes sense. I love my Colorado state. And so I have this project. And all I have to do is write the content and do a podcast episodes if I feel like it. That project in particular is so annoying to me sometimes because it so way outperforms everything else that I do. Easily. Like Denver? I did. Oh my God. Oh my God. You have to understand how many tourists, like just the amount of interest in the state is really high. So in 2022, there were like 90 million tourists. Mm-hmm. 90 million. So I just have, like, just for tourists, not people wanting to move here, people wanting to move out, whatever. People curious. So like 100 million people. I just need like a small percentage of that interest in order to really create a sustainable business. So like I did one podcast episode in 2022 about coffee shops, right? Like for some reason I was like,
right.
Because coffee here is as popular as craft breweries. It's tied. Guess how many freaking listens that one podcast episode got? It was ridiculous.
Wow.
It got 10,000 downloads about coffee. 10,000.
10,000 people listened to you talk about coffee.
Yeah. 10,000. It's the easiest project I've ever worked on. And it pisses me off. Okay. However, if I hadn't done Michelle is Money Hungry and all the hard stuff with that, because that's a hard project, all those skills I just use in these other ways for these other projects. They're so easy because I did all that hard work with this other project. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's building an online brand is wild. There's so many moving parts. It's hard, but it's been... I feel like 2024 is really the year, I think, where all the pieces are coming together. And it's, I am relieved because I was going to quit. I think this is a good thing to end on. I was going to quit. Like 2022 and 2023, I was like, I don't know. This isn't working.
You were going to quit everything. Michelle is Money Hungry. You were going to quit Denver. You were going to,
No, everything. Just everything. Because it's hard. Everything.
Right.
And maybe it could have been a hobby. And I think this is important. A lot of the people that you see who are making good money and building really sustainable businesses, it's a long period of time to build those up. A lot of people will hear of like Michelle Schroeder Gardner, who's lovely. But Michelle, it's funny because I remember when she first got started, because I know Michelle, right? Mm-hmm. And she was working 90 hour weeks. 90 hours a week. I didn't want to do that, especially not when I first quit, because I was exhausted. I didn't have the energy to do that. And so she was able to like cut that time frame significantly because she worked like a crazy person for about 2 years, 90 hour weeks.
Yikes. 2 years.
I can do that now, right? Because I'm energized, I'm relaxed, like I have the bandwidth. Will I do that? Probably not. But I can like really work focused and aggressively now because I'm physically able to do that. But most of the people, if you're watching this, you're like, I want to be a personal finance content creator, blah, blah, blah. Most people, it takes longer than you realize to see the success. And if you're seeing people be successful, if you were to ask them, they would probably be like, oh yeah, for like 5 years I did this thing and this is year seven. like the foundational years are longer than you want to hear, you know? And there's singers. I was thinking about there's singers such as Beyonce. Mm-hmm. Beyonce started when she was like 9, okay?
Yeah.
The woman's 40. She started when she was 9.
What is her song? Like, it's not Born Like This, but she's got a song where it starts off with her getting rejected for a competition. Oh my gosh. I've got to look it up. But I'll...
9.
It's the overnight success that takes 10 years.
Exactly. Tay-Tay, Taylor Swift, same thing. I feel like she was like 11. You know what I mean? So I'm like, you guys, it's hard. It's humbling. If you're doing the kind of work we're doing, it's hard to monetize for a long time. It's hard to do it. And I wish more people would be candid about that.
Yeah. So. The song is called Flawless. It's a song I recommend. Oh. But it's the overnight success takes a while. And I was, like I said at the beginning, it's like moving to Mexico City made it possible for me to keep doing this because the money can be slow to come. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much for being candid on many things, from long COVID to how long it's taken you to be successful as a personal finance content creator and how well, and also the things, it's true what you're saying though, like what you're learning here is helping you over there. I mean, there's so many. I'm a really good money coach because I was a social worker that cried all over my clients, you know. That time as an assistant social worker made it possible for me to learn how to have empathy and like boundaries, because I didn't at the time.
Oh, this is so another conversation. Oh my God. But that'll be on my show.
And I love how you say that you're doing social justice just because of the way that you deliver the information, the way that you have the conversations. You're already putting policy and you're already changing things. So I really appreciate your time, your expertise, and I look forward to being on your show whenever that happens.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I love this conversation. I know that there are more of us out there. I just wish you all good things. I wish you the best. And your work matters. It's so important. And anyone watching this who is very like person led in the work that they do, you've got a tribe. We're here for you. And we want you to continue working on what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye, Michelle.
Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Diana Giselle Yanez. Did you enjoy this episode? Please share this first season of Highly Sensitive Money with others. To learn how you can upskill your money relationship, join the newsletter over at allthecolors.net. That's allthecolors.net for network. Take care, and remember, you've got what it takes to feel good about your money.